know about the whole world of public opinion polling? Well, that's our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. And my guest, Dr. Christopher Borick, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion, is going to enlighten us on this whole world of polling. Chris, I can't wait for this because I often wonder, behind all the statistics that come out in the final reports and polls that we see in the news, what's behind all that? How many people does it take? What kind of a frantic life are they living? Are they glued to screens all the time? All that kind of thing.
Those are great questions, John.
We will get into that. Let me just introduce you to our listeners. Dr. Borick is professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. He's a nationally recognized public opinion researcher who has conducted over 300 large-scale public opinion surveys during the past two decades. That's pretty many, huh? 300. Now, what's the difference between large scale and small scale?
You know, a large scale survey would be a big, we call it a big N study, when we're doing sample sizes, you know, over 300, 400 at least to have that size.
300 or 400 respondents.
Yep, yep.
The results of these surveys have appeared in numerous periodicals, including Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and Washington Post. He has also provided analysis for the BBC, NPR, PBS, MSNBC, CBS News, and NBC Nightly News, and had his survey results aired on CNN, Fox News, and C-SPAN. We just do an alphabet soup here, don't we, with all these different outlets. During his career, he has conducted surveys for a variety of government agencies and organizations, including the Center for Disease Control, the Brookings Institution, PBS, the Wisconsin Department of Commerce, the Oneida Indian Nation. Now, that's interesting. What did the Indian Nation want you to do?
They wanted to sample the nation. They wanted to know what their...
Was it about politics particularly?
It was about the goals and direction of the nation as a whole. So members of the nation, the leaders of the nation wanted to know what their members wanted and hoped for as the leadership directed the nation forward.
Well, let's continue. The U.S. Department of Labor, Habitat for Humanity. Dr. Borick is co-director of the National Surveys on Energy and the Environment and currently conducts surveys for the Morning Call. Professor Borick received his undergraduate education at Penn State and a master's degree from East Stroudsburg University. He completed his doctoral work at the State University of New York at Binghamton in the area of public policy analysis. Were you on campus at Binghamton for your PhD?
I was.
So you were a snowbird for much of the year.
Yeah, I've picked a lot of snowy places to live. Wisconsin, upstate New York. Grew up in Scranton, so this is like the most southern destination for me.
The Lehigh Valley.
It's right.
You came south
for some fun in the sun in the Lehigh Valley.
He has government experience at both the federal and local levels, including positions with the Internal Revenue Service. What position was that that you
had? This was one of my first jobs. I was a taxpayer service representative, so I worked with taxpayers in filling out their taxes.
Does that mean you went after taxpayers?
No, I was on the support side, John. I helped poor people in need of guidance.
You're serious?
Serious.
All right. You see, he has a big smile all the time, so I'm not so sure. And the Monroe County, Pennsylvania Planning Commission. He has published and presented over 30 articles and 4 books in the area of public policy and public opinion, and has held teaching positions at SUNY Cortland, St. Norbert College, which is where?
In Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And Lehigh University, currently at Muhlenberg College. Dr. Borick and his wife Lisa reside in Nazareth. It's a great little town.
It is.
With their two children, Sam, who is 17, and John, who is 13. Congratulations on the choice of the first name for your second son.
John is always
it's excellent.
And underused these days,
yeah.
John.
Yeah, right. And Sam, we know, is a soccer player.
He is. Sam played for Nazareth, and he's considering playing in college.
Is it true that during this past semester at Muhlenberg, when you were allegedly in the classroom, you were really over watching his soccer practices and competition.
That could be true. I watched a lot of soccer with two soccer players over the years. So that's one thing I've become very adept at.
Actually, when I was introducing Christopher Borick, my guest this evening, at a group that over at Muhlenberg College called the Old Gray Mules, I claimed that he spent more time in radio and TV stations than he did on campus. Now that was a cruel comment. Huh?
It could be true.
But it was close. It was a close call.
It was.
So when I was getting ready for this interview, I knew we were going to have fun, and I think our listeners can already hear that Dr. Borick has a very lusty laugh. And it comes through often, even in his teaching, which I have also experienced and survived to tell about it. So let's get into the business of polling and talk about the recent elections that we've had in 2016. I know that you're interested in local elections as well as national. Most people key mostly on presidential election when that comes along. So how did polls perform overall in 2016, and where were they successful, and where did they fail?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question to start with John, and it was, as most of the public would know, a year where the polls had significant struggles, but also, if you look empirically, their struggles might be at sometimes overrated in terms of their performance. So let's start at the national level. National polls try to gauge where the nation as a whole will vote, right, in the general election, the popular vote, in other words. The overall, if you took the average, and that's often what we do in the polling world, we average all the polls together and we say, well, what's the average lead for one candidate over the other? And the final polls this time around showed Hillary Clinton up on the national polls by about 4 points. She ended up winning just the national vote. She didn't win the Electoral College. She's not the president, but she won the popular vote by about 2%, which means the national polls on average were only off by about 2 points in the margin of victory that was predicted in the election. So while I think the perception was the national polls were way off this year, the truth is they weren't. They weren't. In fact, if you went back to 2012, in 2012, the national polls had Barack Obama winning by about 1 point over Mitt Romney. He ended up winning by about 4 and 4.5 points.
So they did more poorly back then.
They did. But of course, how does the public view polls? Do they predict the winner, right? And in this case, the winner is chosen by the Electoral College. So while the public, you know, might say, hey, you know, the, you know, 2 points off isn't that bad, or even think it's not that bad, they want to predict the winners. So on the national level, it certainly was, I think, better performing than the public might give it credit for. Where the problem was, and this is for someone that does polling in a key swing state, appear to be more in the statewide polls, especially in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, where Donald Trump ended up winning very, very close races, you know, under 1% in those states, but nevertheless winning. The polls, none of the aggregate polls in those states had him winning. And in fact, let's look at Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania had, if you took the average of the polls at the end, they had Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton winning by 2 points in Pennsylvania. She ended up losing by almost a point to Donald Trump. So the polls were off by about 3 points on average, which isn't excessive. However, once again, the key is it did not give us the winner. And the bottom line for the public is they expect polls to tell us who's going to win. And in those states, they didn't. And I think that's where a lot of the surprise came this election cycle, and ultimately where a lot of the critical comments and evaluation of the polls rest in this particular election cycle.
When you talk about average of polls, how many polls are involved in how do you decide which polls to put into that basket?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. And it's really decided by the aggregators if they think a poll is worthy of being included in the aggregate. So usually when you see a group like Real Clear Politics or 538 or Pollster.com, those are poll aggregators. They collect polls, they publish polls, they give their the averages. They do a little bit of their own special sauce, if you will, in how they aggregate them. They give weights to some more than others. But it's usually decided on the quality of the poll. Is it transparent enough? In other words, when it was put out by the college, the firm, the research organization, did it have enough detail to allow them to put it into the average, or was it inside information that might not be transparent enough to include? So you could look, I mean, on the national level, their final average of these polls might have included 20 different polls during the last few weeks of the election. In Pennsylvania, a smaller number, so it might have been 6 or 7 different polls included. That was a problem in some states, like Michigan, for example. There just wasn't a lot of polls because it wasn't expected to be as competitive as it was. So I think the number of polls was smaller, and therefore, when you have fewer polls, you have fewer respondents, and that usually leads to a larger degree of uncertainty.
Well, I didn't know anything about these aggregate polling organizations until I sat in on a course that you permitted me to this past semester at Muhlenberg College. And it was on the subject of U.S. elections and campaigns. And you had the students going to these aggregate websites to figure out what they were going. Tell us a little bit about the challenge that you put to the students in that course.
Yeah, you know, that's I like them to, as we try to evaluate elections and predict elections and explain election outcomes, that's what a political scientist does, right? People ask me, what's political science? Well, it's a science of predictive effort and evaluation effort on political phenomena. And one of the big ones is an election outcome, right? We try to predict and explain this, just like a meteorologist might explain the weather. So we have to use data points. We have to use different data points. And polls are one of those big data points, not the only one. There's economic performance. There's historical effects. There's cyclical effects that we see that we weave into our models. But also the polls tell us a lot. And so I have my students spend a lot of time with polls, looking at those aggregators, places like 538 or Real Clear Politics, to get a sense of where the aggregates are, but also to think about what those aggregates might miss sometimes or have problems with. And one of the issues is, you alluded to this a little bit, John, is which polls are included. And sometimes if you include polls that might have had, you know, past track records that aren't great, maybe they're washing out some of the better polls in the S. And so I ask students to evaluate that, which is not easy at all. But as they try to make their predictions, to use data in a very critical way.
We hear a lot of talk these days about the Electoral College, which you mentioned before. So a personal question, your opinion, is the Electoral College worth it? Is it a good system, or as Hillary Clinton supporters would say, it's a terrible system?
Oh, well, that's a really simple question, John. You know, I could answer that in a yes or no. It's of course a very challenging question, because the Electoral College does different things. Now, if you are an advocate that all Americans have equal votes, in other words, one vote, one person, you could have some serious concerns with the Electoral College, because indeed, it's a system that does not value ultimately every American having equal power in the electoral process. It simply does not, as we saw. You know, millions of more people voted for Hillary Clinton. She's not the president. If we have a system that's truly equal power, one vote, one person, same power, you wouldn't have that outcome. Now, of course, historically, we don't just do that. We're just not a nation that's included on one aggregate overall basis. We are a state, a United States of America. And within the United States, given our founding principles, states themselves play a key role not only in governing the people there, but also within the broader electoral format and structure of the federal government. And therefore, when you think about the Electoral College and how we choose presidents, the states, not only the people, but the states as an organizing principle play a key role. And if you value that, if you really have a high value for states themselves, continuing to play a role, and that therefore the residents of those states might be viewed in different ways. The Electoral College has value. It has value in that principle. And so when people ask me to evaluate, it really is what you value the most. Now, I could take a personal preference, and I'm a big fan of one vote, one person, and I think that's an overriding principle that we should elevate beyond things like our allegiance to states. So that's a personal preference that I might lead to more of a popular vote system rather than the Electoral College. But I can see value in those that still hold on to the states as a key component.
If you're living in a state with not that great a population, some of the Western states, if it comes down to one person, one vote, your vote just seems not to count as much.
Yes. You would be lost a lot more. Let's take a place like New Hampshire, right? It has 4 electoral votes. It's a small state. Why was it so hotly contested last time? Why did you have presidential candidates going there? Because the polls showed it was very close. Historically, it's a close state. It was a close election. At least people thought it would be. Those 4 electoral votes could matter. Therefore, you had a lot of attention to that state that if we had a popular vote, there would be no attention. No one would go to New Hampshire. You know, they might go in the primary season, but never in a general election. There's just not enough votes there. Conversely, if you lived in New York or California, Texas, states that are seen as safe states with big populations, they don't get a lot of attention given to them. John, they don't. You don't have the only time candidates go there is for money. They go for fundraisers. So why would you spend a lot of time in a place like that if you know electorally those states are safe? So they don't get the attention. So there are winners and losers in any structured system. If we went to a popular vote, as you mentioned, those small states who are advantaged right now because of the system that they'll draw attention would not see the attention, while the bigger states right now that are often ignored would see more attention.
Yes, they would be the ones getting all the attention from candidates. We want to talk about the national election, which we have been doing so far. We also want to get into locally and what's happened in Pennsylvania and also in our counties here in the Lehigh Valley, Northampton, Lehigh, and perhaps Warren County also, which is in our listening area. And we're going to do that after we take a break. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Christopher Borick, who is professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. He has been widely quoted among sources that I mentioned at the beginning of our program, and he is an expert. Do you ever think of yourself as an expert, Chris?
It's hard for me to use the word expert with myself. So no.
I've always had a problem with that with myself. And yet, let's face it, you are. And you also work with colleagues. There's Terry
Madonna.
Madonna at FNM.
Yeah, great pollster. We've worked with a lot over the years.
And you work with these different people, and it must be very stimulating. So we're going to get into some more on politics and polling. When we continue, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond. I'm your host, John Pierce. Our engineer today is Neil Heaver, our director of operations here at WDIY. And my guest, Dr. Christopher Borick from Muhlenberg College, is telling us about polling and how to get public opinion in a way that, Chris, you said it one time, you just love statistics. You love data.
I do. I think, and it's not for the love of numbers themselves, although I like math, I like statistics. It's the ability to tell stories with data, what the public believes, what the public wants, what the public intends to do. And it's challenging, of course. You know, we're trying to predict behaviors and beliefs. But I am just fascinated by it, and I have been for a long time. And so I'm very lucky to be in a field that allows me to do that. I'm curious. I'm a very curious person. I want to know what people think, and on a whole, on an aggregate, what the public thinks about issues. I think it's a really key part of society, understanding what people want and think, and this helps us do that.
How does a pollster deal with the possibility that, and the probability that, somebody answering questions in a poll is not telling the truth, is not telling really what he feels?
Yeah, and that could be, you know, we can go back to this race and talk perhaps about the silent Trump voter in a little while, but it's on a more broad perspective, John, it's a challenge. And we recognize, you go into that recognizing, right, that especially if the material you're covering is very personal, or that individuals might have a really good reason to give an answer other than the one that is truly inside them. And again, when I teach classes on this, there is a reality. People say, well, what's the reality? You have a belief in your head. You believe something. You have a preference in who you were going to vote for. It was real. It's there. There's a reality out there that we try to measure. And sometimes people don't want to share the reality with you for reasons. One of the big factors we call is social desirability, that there is a social desirability to express certain behaviors or of how you behave or what you believe or what you want. And that depends on what society you live in and where and what time. You know, we were talking earlier, perhaps on a liberal college campus, one that's more left-leaning, might be harder to express conservative beliefs, right? That you are in that perspective, or maybe you're in a religious community that's more conservative, and you have some liberal beliefs. So when asked about something, you might not want to express it. So as a pollster, we have to recognize that, and therefore ask questions in ways that try to get around that social desirability. We try to make it okay to say something to a pollster or someone that's polling you that you might otherwise feel concerned about. And a lot of that has to do with question wording and sometimes using proxies and other factors, all that are challenging, but we have to go into that expecting those issues to be a challenge for us.
Let's talk about, since you mentioned the silent Trump voter, who are these people? Could you figure out what demographic slice they come from?
We are. That's one of the major jobs we're doing right now, John, post-election, kind of our post-mortem and our data analysis at Muhlenberg, like a lot of other pollsters are. We had an interesting phenomena this year. So our final poll in Pennsylvania had Donald Trump losing to Hillary Clinton by 4 points. Of course, he won by, you know, almost 1 point. So we were off by about 4.5 points. However, we also polled other races at the same time. We polled the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania between Senator Toomey and Kathleen McGinty. And in that race, using the same methods, same poll, same time, we had Senator Toomey winning by 1 point. He won by 1 point, a little over 1 point. So one of our polls that we were working on at the very same time using the same methods was dead on. The other was off by about 4.5 points. You know, within our margin of error, but still off, which really sets up well if you are a believer in the silent Trump phenomena, that our methods in a more traditional race, like the Toomey-McGinty race, where there wouldn't be a big social desirability to say I'm, you know, voting for one over the other, people would express more readily their beliefs compared to a race like the Trump-Clinton race, where some individuals, because of Donald Trump's controversial nature and statements, might say, you know, I don't feel comfortable telling a pollster I'm voting for him, but I might vote for him. So our results are aligned with the silent Trump hypothesis. A lot of other polls don't seem to match that. And so that our methods might be different than some of the others in that. But individuals might not have felt comfortable. One kind of last fact I'll say about that. In our very last poll, we had about 7% of our respondents tell us they were going to vote for Gary Johnson, the third party candidate, which when I saw that, I said, well, that's pretty high. I was skeptical that that was the number. He ended up getting Johnson about 2.5 points. You know, we were off by about 4 points on that. I have a feeling, although we're going to have to work on this to see if we could deduce the results, that a lot of those folks in our last poll that said they were going to vote for Johnson were Trump voters that were still reticent at the end to maybe express that support. And we were capturing them the way we were asking questions as leaning towards Gary Johnson, when in reality they were Trump voters.
Can you think of any examples from the past where there would be a silent group like this the silent Trump voters in previous presidential elections or local?
Yeah, not a presidential election per se. You know, there was a lot of speculation back in 2008 with President Obama, then candidate Obama's candidacy, that there might be individuals that because of social desirability were going to say that they were going to vote for President Obama because they didn't want to seem perhaps having any racial prejudices, but that they might not vote. That turned out to be an assumption that wasn't true. You know, the polls were pretty accurate in predicting, and people expressed themselves. What that fear in 2008 was about, people not being honest, dated back to what is often called the Bradley effect. The Bradley effect was a mayor in Los Angeles, California. Mayor Bradley, when he was running for office, the polls showed him up by a much greater number than he actually won by. And the question was, was that the effect, what's become known as the Bradley effect, where people saying, oh, yeah, I'm voting for Bradley, but ultimately didn't vote for him because of other factors, perhaps racial factors. But when they were asked a pollster, that they would say, oh, yes, I'm voting for him. And then the concern that they didn't vote ultimately because of those prejudices.
Back in 1967, I went out to the Los Angeles area for Peace Corps training, training others who were going into the Peace Corps. And Ronald Reagan was governor of California at that time. And when I talked to people about it, oh, it was just nothing but terrible comments. I would never vote for him. I don't understand. And I'm thinking to myself, somebody voted for him. I just wasn't hitting individuals who happened to be on the same wavelength as Ronald Reagan. Overall, would you say the media covered polls in a responsible way in this last election cycle?
It's a really salient question right now to be asking, John. And, you know, I'm someone that, as you mentioned, works a lot with the media. Extreme respect for lots of the journalists and media outlets I work with. I don't think this election cycle was the most shining moment for the media in terms of poll coverage. I think there was, you know, and it might be the unique nature of these candidates and Donald Trump, as I said before, as an individual, as a candidate, with his rhetoric, his statements, the way he handled himself. That there was when the polls came out, I think there was a belief that if Hillary Clinton was leading in these polls by a few points, and that Donald Trump was so out there in a lot of different ways with his statements, his actions, his rhetoric, that he can't possibly lose, that she can't possibly lose. It was an impression among, I think, some journalists. And that the polls were, again, this is on us, the polls were showing that Hillary Clinton was ahead, and she ended up winning the popular vote. But even in states like Pennsylvania, where she was up by a few points at the end on the average, that, oh, okay, there's no chance that she could. When you really look at polls being an estimate, right, that I think there was more, looking back in retrospect, uncertainty than perhaps the media gave to polls at the time, that they were using them as being almost the word of God in terms of the results here, rather than a poll and giving some predictions and not taking them perhaps for what they are. They're estimates based on probability of what will happen. And, you know, even as I talked about our polls, and I think for all those factors we talked about, the silent Trump effect and others, especially in the presidential race, it was a challenging race to poll. But even that, you know, if we were within the margin of error, you should say, okay, this poll's in the margin of error, right? It's a race that's competitive. And I think in many ways the media, in a lot of cases, might have dropped the ball a little bit in expressing that there was more uncertainty than was there.
What does the public most commonly misunderstand about polling in general?
Yeah, this kind of goes back to our discussion of the media just a second ago. The idea that first of all, how polls work, right? I mean, we are as a society perhaps sometimes not as adept at looking at math and probability as we might otherwise or hope to be, right? And then how this works. So I get critiques all the time, and any poll that we do for the 20 years I've been doing it, you know, someone will say, how do you know with, you know, 500 people, how could you have any idea what the public thinks about, right? That's only 500 people, and I never get called, and I'm not, you can't possibly do that. And that's the idea is probability works. If you understand probability, if you take samples of things, you could be pretty predictive. Now, that's not perfect, right? And that's maybe what the public on one hand is skeptical of the whole process of polling. And skepticism is a good thing, but skepticism should be based on information. That sometimes the public is so skeptical that they discount, and then other times they look at it, as I said before, almost as this perfect prediction of what's going to happen. And it's, I think, a place in between those two spots is where the public, I would love them to be, where they are skeptical to a degree, but also understand the fundamentals of probability sciences and statistics enough to say, okay, you could, if you do this right, you could get a good estimate of what the public thinks. At the same time, it's not putting complete confidence in a number to say, well, that's what's going to happen. When I say, you know, there's a, you know, 50% of the public believes this, well, it's probably between 45 and 55, right? Maybe not exactly 50.
I think that the public accepts this uncertainty with weather forecasting. And when I listen to a weather forecast, I think to myself, maybe, maybe not. And is there an analogy here with the polling?
I love it because I'm also a weather junkie. I think I was designed to be a meteorologist, but maybe I stumbled into
political
science.
Maybe in the next life,
John. But that's great. I use the weather analogy all the time when I talk about predicting elections, right? You know, what factors go in? You know, if a meteorologist looks at humidity, they look at winds, they look at barometric pressure, they look at temperature, right? And then they give a prediction. Well, this what should happen if we model it. But when you get a prediction using those models, for example, of, you know, we're going to have 1 to 3 inches of snow or 3 to 6, people aren't freaked out generally if, you know, that gets 2.5 or 6.5, right? You know, it's a range that we use based on good empirical models and probability, right? What should happen. And these are probability-based models, a little different type of probability, but ultimately the same function. And that's when we give a number when we're predicting an election, it's an estimate, right? Based on some good science and with pretty good track records, despite some of the failures that we've seen, and that therefore the public should take it for what it is, right? And that's back to what we talked about the media this cycle. You look at some of those numbers at the end, you know, a 1.9% average lead for Clinton in Pennsylvania, and you might say, well, okay, you know, that's pretty close. Could it flip? And that was, again, the ultimate results of that race were Trump won by, you know, 40,000 votes, less than 1% in the state. It wasn't incredibly far off, but certainly disappointing to those that were putting complete faith in that
right.
That number.
And again, as you said, John Q. Public is expecting for the polls at least to come up with the winner.
Yes.
Despite what if it's by 1 point or 4 points or what, I think we don't pay much attention to that outside of the polling community.
You're right, and that's it's hard to fault the public for wanting to know who the winner is, right? We want in games, right? We ultimately that's what we want, and if we consider it, I'm not a big fan of politics as a game, but if we want to see the winner of the game, then I think that's a reasonable expectation, but not one that polls could necessarily deliver on. I'll give one example of this. Some polls this year on the national level predicted Donald Trump would win the national vote. Like the USC poll and the International Business Daily polls, had Trump winning by 2 or 3 points in the general election. And those polls, I've heard people hailing those polls as being successful this year. Oh, they predict the winner. Those polls, in my mind, were much farther off than a poll that on the national level where Hillary Clinton won by 2 points. So if a poll predicted, for example, that Hillary would win by 4 points, that's a 2 point difference from reality and the poll compared to those polls that predicted Trump was going to win the popular vote by 3 points, which are off by 5 or 6 points. Which is the better poll, I would ask? I think the one that was closest to the actual margins, the better poll, even if it didn't predict the winner of the Electoral College. It's a whole different game, right? So it's a challenge.
That's one of the challenges of polling today. Chris, we haven't talked yet about types of polls, sending questions over the internet or paper questions that people might answer, having a person come to the door and ask questions. How does all that fit together?
Yeah, this is, John, a turbulent time in the industry because of the changing ways of communication, the ways that people can be reached, how they respond to polls, how they don't respond, how we reach people is changing quickly. You know, maybe 40 years ago, 50 years ago, the standard means of collecting polls was still face-to-face interviews. Folks like in the Gallup poll or the Roper polls or Lou Harris, those pioneers in the polling industry, still relied largely on going door-to-door and doing polls. That's how the origins of it was, in a probability way.
And what decade are we talking about?
This was in the 50s, the early 60s, late 40s, when polling was really coming into form. That was the method, and all the way up into the 70s, in fact. You saw this being the dominant method for a lot of pollsters. Then, of course, it transferred over to telephones. As telephones became ubiquitous within the American population, and everybody could be reached by phone, you started seeing a transfer over to that method, and that became the dominant method. When I started polling back in the 90s, it was dominant. However, as everybody knows, that's changed over time, right? It used to be all landlines. Everybody had a landline. It was easy to do a probability-based survey. Over time, as landlines have departed as a dominant means and cell phones have come in, we, in our polling methods, have accounted for that. You know, we do a lot more cell phone calls than landlines for many of our polls, especially non-election polls. But that's even becoming challenging in itself because of questions of, you know, portability of landlines and trying to get different populations, given that people take their phones all over the place. It becomes pretty challenging. Therefore, we're exploring right now, and we saw this in the last election cycle and at Muhlenberg and other organizations, different online methods of polling, which are very diverse. When I say online, there could be a whole array that I'd be happy to talk to after the break of how we might use online methods to reach out to the public or even you know, back to the old mail surveys that were used years ago. So there's a variety of methods, and it's a challenging time to predict just which one is the best at any given time.
Let's talk about that right after the break. By the way, how'd you know we're coming up on a break?
I just, you know, I have the sense.
You have eyes in the back of your head. That's why you're such a good pollster. My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Christopher Borick, who is professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. And Muhlenberg works heavily with the Morning Call on polls these days. Stay with us. We will be back after this break.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host, and working the board for us this evening is Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations here at WDIY. My guest, Dr. Christopher Borick from Muhlenberg College, is enlightening us on the whole area of public opinion polling. Chris, I think that you established the polling institute at Muhlenberg College. Is that right?
That's true.
Were you hired there to do that?
Yeah, indirectly. It's an interesting story. I was teaching out in Wisconsin, as you noted earlier, for 6 years, and I ended up directing a research center in Green Bay at St. Norbert College Survey Center, which was one of the original college survey centers in the country. I'd gone out there to teach political science. The director of that institute stepped down, and I ended up taking over the position. Really enjoyed it. Using my background in stats and public policy and public opinion. But we decided, I'm a native Pennsylvanian, so is my wife. We grew up in the Scranton area. We wanted, once we had our first child, to move back to eastern Pennsylvania. Started looking for jobs. Saw the Muhlenberg job. Was lucky enough to get an interview. And
that was for...
political science.
For political science, so, well, not for polling.
Yeah, there was no institute, so it was just for... person that did my areas of political science. So I came and I talked, and they were interested. The president of the college at that time, Arthur Taylor, did a lot of media work with CBS, his background as president of CBS, said, hey, this thing you do at St. Norbert, can you do that here? And I said, well, if we found the resources and you were able to, you know, create the facilities, I'd be happy to do that here. And he said, well, okay. And lucky for me, I was hired. The administration at the college was very supportive in putting together the resources for the institute. And we started in 2001, shortly after I got here, with a few projects. And little by little over the years, you know, it's 15, 16 years later, we've been one of the longest running polls in the state. There's, you know, folks like Terry Madonna down at Franklin and Marshall were around before that, but not many other ones, and we've been around since.
Well, congratulations. It's worked well.
It has. It's been a good run.
Yeah. You say that you were lucky to land this position, but Muhlenberg has really come out to be lucky to have you there.
That's sweet.
We're talking about the particular situation at Muhlenberg, how does that operate? Do you have students working on it a lot? What's the facility like? If we walked in, what would we see?
Yeah, it is a largely student-run organization. That's one of our qualities, and we've been focused for students as a liberal arts college for a long time when we created it. So I'm the director on the professional staff. We have some Maureen Bayraktar, who's our basically the manager of the institute's web page. It's, you know, our finances, kind of paying the bills, doing all the things that we do. And then besides the two of us, it's all students. Students run the lab where we do our polling. They manage the interviewing process. They do the interviewing process. They do a lot of the data collection and data analysis. They help with report writing. The students are central. It is a student-oriented institute. The physical place where we do the polling is far from a beautiful location. It's in our library at Muhlenberg, which is a beautiful library, but we're on the the basement floor, the sea level. There's A, B, and C levels.
No windows?
There are no windows. Oh. It's back in it. So my students laugh about the conditions of no natural light, and yeah. it's fairly cramped and with cubicles. So it's not the most attractive place.
How many students would be working in that room at any one time?
We could have up to about 15 people working at any given time, and during election seasons, it's packed. You know, we have people in there all the time through all the hours that we work. It's a hive of activity.
Are most of the students political science majors?
No, that's the interesting part of it. I'd say we're political science majors might be disproportionately representative a little bit more, but our staff comes from all over the college. We have lots of theater majors. We have biology majors. We have psychology majors. I'm just thinking about what we call our management staff right now, which is made up of about 6 students that run the lab and do the payroll and all the things. I have a neuroscience, the co-directors right now, one's in neuroscience and international studies. The other co-director is a physics and theater major. I have a biology and public health major on staff. We have an economics major. So they really do come from an array of disciplines on campus.
That's great, especially to hear that young people are interested in public opinion polling, and I think you have to be interested in politics also to want to get into this area.
Yeah, I think, and we really see a lot of the people that work with us, the students do have a broader interest, even if they're not studying it as an academic major, they're still interested in politics, but they're also interested in a lot of the other research. We do, besides our focus on elections during election seasons, our other big area is environmental policy. We do, as you mentioned before, one of our big ongoing surveys is with the University of Michigan called the National Surveys of Energy and the Environment. We do this twice a year looking across America at climate change, perceptions of climate change, energy policy. So a lot of our students that come for an interest in environmental issues, environmental policy, plug into those surveys. So there's a diversity of projects that we do that draw students in.
Is that particular one with the University of Michigan only Muhlenberg and Michigan?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting arrangement. Since 2008, we've partnered with the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, and Barry Rabe, who's the director there, in a twice annual survey. We do it in the spring and the fall nationally in cooperation with Michigan in conjunction, where we poll Americans on all things related to climate change. Do they believe it? What do they think the causes are? What kind of things do they want to have done? What effect does weather have on it? It's a big instrument that we do have been doing now for 2008. This is its ninth year. It'll be the ninth year coming up.
How did you get connected with the University of Michigan?
I from my research, because I do a lot of public policy research, years ago, Barry Rabe, who's the director of the center that we work with there, and I had worked on a lot of panels at conferences together. We struck up a friendship and then a writing relationship, did a number of papers together. And as we moved along, the weird little side story, we participated in a conference at the University of Virginia that Barry was operating or running at the time on climate governance. And we said, well, maybe we could do a survey, since I do surveys, as just part of this project. And we said, oh, that was kind of fun. Maybe we'll do another one. And then we started the process.
Great chemistry between you and him.
It is. It's
and
a great relationship.
What's interesting is that here you have this huge university in Ann Arbor, and we have this small college in Allentown. Working together,
that doesn't happen
very much.
No, it doesn't. We've done a couple of pieces on that because it is a really unique relationship. Having a liberal arts college and a major research organization partner, we haven't found many quite like it. This type of partnership, and we've done things with our classes and others. It's been one of my favorite aspects of my job and my professional career working with Michigan and tying it in with Muhlenberg.
Just stay away from Ann Arbor in the wintertime. I know of what I speak.
It's not. I end up going up there two or three times a year with the project. It seems way too often that it is in January or February.
So, Chris, what do you see as the value of polling in society?
It to me is now we focus so much on elections, right? And I'm to be honest, I'm a little I've concerns about that focus, and as someone that's complicit in it by producing election polls, because I know the public wants them, the media likes them, they draw in attention. But to me, they are the horse race polls in an election are probably the least valuable aspects of public opinion research. What I think is most valuable is understanding the whys, you know, why people would vote a certain way, what they care about, what they hope to see, what they need, what they are willing to do, what they want elected officials to do. In a democracy, we have different ways of weighing in, and every so often we have elections, and we have a chance to weigh in at the ballot box. You could contact elected officials to try and get them to do things and express your opinion. But how do you measure the public's preferences and attitudes on an array of issues that might inform policymakers and the public as a whole? And that's where I think public opinion research comes in. What does the public hope for? What does it need? What does it want? And so to me, it's always been such a fundamental research interest for me, but also one that I think dovetails nicely with democratic theory and democratic system operation, small, you know, D in both of these, that the idea that if you do a good job of understanding what the public wants through methodologically rigorous approaches of polling, you can give policymakers, decision makers at all levels, federal, state, local, organizational, right? If you are a nonprofit, to understand what your public wants or needs, that's where public opinion research comes in. And that's why I'm very passionate about that type of work.
And that obviously goes right on into your students, because you're talking about this consistently. You, of your teaching load as you go through semester by semester, do you have more than one course involving polling heavily?
Yes, shockingly, yes, John. I would do that. So
have you completely abandoned political science?
Yeah, there's going to be a poll in almost every class. But of course, you know, I do see the connection. So let's just talk about this upcoming semester. I teach public health policy. That's one of environmental and public health are two of the areas I teach a lot of classes in. So my public health class, for the last 5 years or so, has a major survey component in it. We've conducted and created a survey in these classes where the students originate questions related to public health needs. And in the field of public health, surveys are crucial, understanding behavioral risks of the public. Some of the biggest surveys nationally are from organizations like the CDC or the Center for Health Statistics. Those organizations do big scale surveys to try and measure public behaviors on things like smoking or alcohol abuse or drug abuse, or you know, eating habits, all these things. So I plug that into this public health class every year. The students get to originate the questions. I help put it into the form of a final instrument. We collect that survey at the Institute of Public Opinion, with the students in the class joining the staff of the institute to actually collect the surveys. Then it comes back to them in data form to the students in this class, and they get to test hypotheses that are related to them. So if they wanted to understand, you know, why someone would support certain health policies, or perhaps why someone might engage in risky behaviors, they could test it out on the data that they collected and designed. And then they make policy recommendations at the end based on the data. So maybe it means more education or more incentives to get people to behave in certain ways. So it comes full circle. So I see this beautiful component of public opinion research tied to the fundamental aspects of public health. So that's my lens to a lot of things.
I wonder if a person would find another professor teaching public health concerns, would do a polling part of the course if he's not into polling the way you are.
Yeah, no, and probably not, and rightly so, and they might have their own focus, right? So I imagine a lot of similar public health policy classes talk about survey data, right? And they might use CDC data, which is readily available, and they'll bring that in and some of the great surveys that are out there to use their students, but maybe not as big of a focus on the development and implementation. Every professor, as you know, often teaches to their strengths and things that they're interested in. So my twist, right, being a public opinion researcher when I do public health or environmental policy, is probably to bring in more public opinion data and originate public opinion data as part of the research process. That's the value added of Boric as your professor, as opposed to someone else whose value added might be their practical experience in the field, perhaps of implementing a public health policy or
right.
something like that.
Well, I think the interesting part that you've just described is that the students themselves create questions and they do polling. Do their conclusions ever go outside the classroom?
Oh yeah, it's a wonderful question and one that because of the Institute's reach, if you will. We always publish those. We often share them with a media partner like the Morning Call or other media outlets in the state. And the interesting thing I always sell to them is, hey, look, this is going to be shared with the public. There's going to be stories about this. Hopefully policymakers see it. So this doesn't rest only in our class or with your research paper. So, for example, last year we did a lot on heroin. And the heroin epidemic in Pennsylvania, and asked a lot of questions. The students were interested in it. We put a big component of that in our survey. They analyzed it, and then when we released it to the public, through the Institute, it received lots of attention. You know, we showed that about half of Pennsylvanians have had a direct impact with somebody they know or in their family with an opioid addiction. And that got a lot of attention, right? And got a lot of attention, and it really originated with their research, and we helped carry it through. So over the years, we've put this out every spring. It's on our website. People can go see these surveys, and a lot of people use them.
Let's give that website right now for our listeners.
Well, the easiest way to do it is just go to muhlenberg.edu. And then once you get to there, just link in. You'll see a link to the various institutes at the college through the directory and just Institute of Public Opinion.
Chris, would you believe our time is up?
I can't. That was fun.
When you're having fun, it goes quickly. Dr. Christopher Boric, thanks so much for coming over to our microphones here at WDIY for a really interesting hour of talking about public opinion polling. Chris is professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion, and we wish you all success in the future.
Thanks so much, John.
That wraps it up for Lehigh Valley Discourse for this time. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thanks to Neil Heaver for doing our engineering this evening. I'm John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.